Hello. This week we're looking at how English has spread around the world and at its effect on other peoples and cultures. How, for example, did this extraordinary form of English emerge in West Africa?
Now, who are the Siso?
Namio.
This is your eye.
And me, my brother, which never do. You know, say work plenty. No rest, nothing. Every time I do for work.
Now, you go hide yourself.
You don't see me now, which you get for tell me.
Says you don't dry, sir.
And I walk, as I tell you.
For the answer, I went to Leeds University to meet Loretto Todd, an authority on world Englishes. Unfortunately, I neglected to brush up on my pidgin.
Uh-huh, Nasro, now who there? Uh-huh, now Bill, my brother, how you there?
I'm very well, thank you. You must be Loretto Todd.
Nasro, how country, Bill?
Country
fine?
Very, very well, thank you.
Thank you plenty. Me too, I find bad. Me are there for Leeds. For which place you been come out this morning?
I came this morning from York.
Who saw you to go today?
Today, then from here we go on to Leicester.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, me are get for she down here for Leeds. I go stay here sote, but I like I'm bad.
You
hungry bad? Hungry to do you?
Hungry real bad, yes.
Aha, uh-huh. I think so then we fit chop. No be so?
Chop sounds great.
Okay, I think say we go chop. That one fine? I go do?
A pidgin is a rudimentary language that emerges when people from two different language groups come together, usually for purposes of trade or commerce. When contact between those two groups is prolonged, the pidgin will sometimes evolve into a more formalized tongue known as a creole. To the uninitiated, there is a tendency to regard both pidgins and creoles as rather comical, substandard languages. In fact, as Loretto Todd makes clear, they are, in their way, as sophisticated and expressive as any other language in the world, sometimes more so.
The pidgin in various West African countries is very special in that it's a type of halfway house between their own culture and the European culture, if you like. They're using English words and phrases, but it's expressing an African culture.
But does the vocabulary tend to be universal throughout?
Yes, you've got a core vocabulary that would be universal. I mean, you've got things like the majority of verbs come, go, take, bring, put. You've got a core vocabulary. You've got body parts. You've got numbers and so on. So you've got a lot of vocabulary that would be shared. Again, in different regions, you might get borrowings from different local languages. But since the pidgin was meant to be the language that allowed communication where previously none was possible, it's terribly important that it doesn't change too much. And what would be the point of having something that was meant to facilitate communication if it was no good to you once you left your own country? So in fact, you find that even words that are used differently from the way they're used in English are often common throughout the area. Shall I give you an example?
Please.
If you take an example like chop, which can mean food or eat, chop fine, you know, like bon appétit. Eat well, chop fine. Or, I know but chop no nothing. I haven't eaten anything. Take this chop, go. Take this food away. So you've got that word chop. And you would find that all the way from Gambia down to, shall we say, Cameroon, with the same meaning. It can function as a noun, it can function as a verb. I mean, people don't go around saying, oh gosh, I'm going to use it as a verb now, but really that's what it's doing. You say, chop I'm fine, you know, eat it. Or it can function as an adjective of sorts, in the sense that if I say to you, you chop masa, na die, you eat a great deal. Chop masa, chop master. You're really eating well. Then, if you like, you could say that's functioning as an adjective. But it's the same word throughout the area.
A pass entrance, a pass and proper.
Who? How you take pass and?
Now for land book.
Abi then gear and something chop.
Did you man know that for this kind of thing? They say the boy gave.
Can I ask you what is the health of pigeons? Are they thriving or...?
They are. You see, one of the things that's intriguing is you might think that they would develop closer and closer and closer to English. And sometimes in vocabulary you would think that. But the basic language, which is unbelievably easy to learn. And I mean that. For example, you take the verbs. There's only one form. You know how in English you have I walk, you walk, he was walking, he walked, that sort of thing. And it's even worse if you've got an irregular verb. But in the pigeons, you tend to have one form, waka. And that is for any form. The past is indicated by a little auxiliary. So you'd say, awaka, that's now I walk. If you want to indicate that you're going on, you're walking at this particular time, you'd say, adiwaka. If you want to say, I walked yesterday, abinwaka yesterday. I will walk, agowaka tomorrow. And in that sense, you only have to learn a relatively small vocabulary, and you've got the same little auxiliaries, as it were, that can indicate all sorts of nuances of time and aspect. One of the best ways to illustrate the subtlety and the effectiveness of pidgin is to quote a couple of proverbs for you. Because in these proverbs, you get encapsulated wisdom. I mean, Chinua Achebe once said that they were the palm wine with which words are eaten. And so you get little proverbs like, one hand no fit tie bundle. You cannot tie a parcel with one hand. You need cooperation. Or you get one like, dog elas na God declinam. And that really means that God wipes the dog's backside. And initially you might think that's a relatively unpleasant one. But what it means is God helps those who cannot help themselves, which from my point of view is infinitely, that's a nicer God than the God who only helps those who help themselves.
My father, before my father getting wife of Boku, he no get equality palava. He live well for he be a guy for his own house. But that time don't pass before white man come with him one wife for one man.
There is a tendency among some people to smile at the quirky ways people from other language groups deal with English syntax or pronunciation. But as Dr. Todd points out, they are simply grafting an internal logic from their own languages onto English.
In our restaurant, we serve basically curry, but tandoori is, as people are getting used to it, they're eating more and more. But at the big restaurants or the more popular restaurants, they have started on the menu to explain the dishes, and which is making much easier for the customers.
One of the things that people notice most about a quote-unquote Indian accent is, again, what linguists call retroflexion. In other words, when you're speaking, you turn the tongue round a little bit. And so you would say things like, what do you intend to do today? And turning the tongue round, you immediately just begin to sound that little bit Indian. I'm not trying to be insulting or anything. And that is part of an articulatory setting of the Indian languages. And so when that generation comes over to this country that was brought up speaking an Indian language, they will carry their retroflexion over into English. Yes, not only their retroflexion, but features like saying things like, I'm thinking about him all the time. I am listening. I am seeing him now. That sort of construction that we often think about, because their own languages permit them to use the progressive form with any verb, whereas in English we have limitations on it. But it's the same with another Indianism that we tend to think about is someone will say, I'm going to pictures, and they will not use the definite article. And you say to somebody, well, why don't you use the definite article? And then you think, how on earth? I would say I'm going to hospital, but I'm going to the pictures. English is incredible when you think about its use of definite and indefinite articles. And so either people will generalize and cut it out altogether, or they will follow the influence of their own language, where they may not have a particular article in their own languages. I mean, Irish, for example, doesn't have an indefinite article. It's nothing inferior about a language, it's just a fact.
It is little wonder that people are sometimes tripped up by the intricacies of English. It is a remarkably complex language. Take a simple word like set. It has 58 separate meanings as a noun, 126 as a verb, and 10 as a participial adjective. It takes the Oxford English Dictionary 60,000 words, the length of a short novel, to define them all. Or consider phrasal verbs. That is, verb phrases that change meaning through the addition of a preposition, as in look up, look at, look over, and look round. Native speakers tend to take these for granted, but for anyone learning English, they can be extremely bewildering. Listen to Dr. John Wright discussing their mysteries with French, German, Spanish, and Korean students in Bristol.
Have a quick look at the phrasal verbs. Have we mentioned all of these or any of these? Like makeup has different meanings. You make yourself up before a party, and I just made up an example. And I'm sorry that I insulted you yesterday. I'll make it up to you.
Yes.
And we're a bit late. We'll have to make up time. Different meanings.
What is ketchup?
Good question.
It's not the...
Who's tomatoes?
No, nothing to do with tomato ketchup. No. Have you heard that, Sandra?
When you
ketchup?
Take a bus, right? When you get on a bus, you can use ketchup.
No, we would say catch, but when you have the particle up, catch up, it creates another meaning, a different meaning, which is one problem. That's catch, but not catch up again. Any more which are new here? How did you find that? Was that easy or difficult?
Difficult.
Right. And what makes phrasal verbs difficult for you?
Because in English, there is lots of exception.
And if I put another preposition after the verb, the meaning change again.
Can you think of an example like that? So if you say look as the basic verb.
Look up, look out, look for.
Look after.
Look after.
The baby.
Yeah, look into
for,
a problem. Do you have anything similar in your language?
No.
So it's a special feature of English for you. Okay.
Yes.
Any other problems with phrasal verbs? Do you find it difficult to understand if people use one?
Oh, yes, of course.
Why?
First of all, it's difficult to understand everything that English people say. But phrasal verbs, it's difficult to use, so it's difficult to understand.
Ayako Matsuo teaches Japanese studies at Manchester University. I asked her if it is difficult for the Japanese to learn English.
The answer is mixed. To start with, lots of people would like to speak English because it's not just English language, but it's world language. So particularly young people, it's also the language for music, arts, all sorts of things. So they would like to learn, but they somehow think, learning English is wonderful but difficult.
When you were learning English, were you struck by any particular difficulties, any quirks of the English language that threw you or amused you? Or?
I find English spelling is difficult because it's not like you don't spell like you pronounce.
Yeah.
And I find lots of idioms is difficult. And still I'm struggling with prepositions, which prepositions to use. And passive forms, I find it difficult, and some tense. Yeah, lots of things. The more you know about English, you feel more, it's a difficult language. I feel like it's still a long way to master English.
And what about, was there anything that impressed you about English? That you thought, this is something in this foreign language that actually we don't have in our own, or it works better at doing certain things?
English. I think it's also the variety. Japanese is a bit similar because we borrow lots of words and got into English, but English has a similar history. You learned some Latin words or Greek words and French words, and these days Japanese words as well. So we think Japanese is quite a flexible language. We can actually import some English words and we put it like tape recorder. So we thought it's flexible, but English probably also bit of a flexible language, blowing lots of words.
And conversely, have you found any deficiencies in English that you find that it's difficult to express?
Pronunciation is difficult. In Japanese, we don't have any L and R distinction, and my English sometimes causes lots of problems.
No fewer than 20,000 words of English origin are now comfortably ensconced in the Japanese language, though often with modifications that do not always make the source immediately evident. Productivity, for instance, became, and my apologies to any Japanese speakers for my pronunciation, puru daku chibichi. Elevator, meanwhile, became arabeta, beefsteak bifuteki, salad sarada, and cheese chiizu. Altogether, as much as 10% of Japanese vocabulary is thought to be based on Western words, most of them from English. Elsewhere, the march of English into other languages has been scarcely less profound. In Eastern Europe, the fall of communism and the emergence of a free market meant increased exposure to Western goods, but also to the language of capitalism. I asked Peter Kohivchak from the Department of Translation Studies at Warwick University what influences this had had on language in his native Poland.
Well, the English has for a long time been an important language in Poland, but after 1989 it's become even more important, not only in Poland, in other East European countries. People very soon realized that the way of communicating with the outside world and the way success means learning English and being able to communicate in English.
And to what extent has English become the language of commercial discourse?
The pace of change is so fast that the language cannot catch up with it. So very often it's much easier to conduct the conversation in English using English vocabulary. The businessmen or the city people, if you listen to them, you find out that 40% of the vocabulary they are using is English. I've got the magazine here. It's the magazine is the equivalent of the Polish equivalent of, I don't know, of the American Times, but it's for the Poles. And if you look at advertisements, a lot of them are, a big part of them is in English. This one says, "Watch the world." And this is the advertisement of for the Swiss Tissot watches. And a lot of these texts are in English. Now, what it signifies means that English is the language of prestige, on one hand, that's you are in. But also the people who advertise, they know that this is the language of prestige, and it goes with upward movement, social movement. So people who have English, they've got the access to better life. And it's true, and you've got better prospects. You earn more money. So it's a part of the economic phenomenon. And as you drive around Poland, you'll be surprised how many shops, how many enterprises provide information in English in the street signs. It's very little at the moment. There's very little concern of what happens to Polish if you do that. Somehow the Poles haven't got as many anxieties as the French have got. And there is no resistance to it. Then it does happen.
We make it sound as if not only is there no resistance, but it's actually embraced.
Yes, it is embraced, yes. Yes, it is embraced.
Sometimes, however, there is a resistance to the incursions of English, as the writer Marika Kobold discovered when her novel Guppies for Tea was translated from English, in which it was written, into her native Swedish. Even the most common English expressions were ruled inadmissible.
I had this argument with my publishers and the translator, and I said, surely everyone will understand this particular expression. But they said it's not only a matter of that, but it's a big debate going on, and reviewers and people, the Guardian of the Swedish language, sort of, they hate it's getting in more and more into Swedish people are more and more using English words and translators are leaving them in. So they are trying to clamp down on that, which is fair enough.
To what extent is that sort of infection from the English-speaking world a genuine concern? I mean, you know how the French are
exactly
often obsessed by Anglicisms creeping into their language, flooding into their language. Is that same thing happening in Sweden? And are people quite concerned about it?
I think it's of concern, but not in any way in the same way as it is in France. I think people are just... It's an intellectual debate now, and people are guarding against it in translation works. And when they write themselves, it's even for a Swede writing in Swedish, it seems to be easier sometimes to grab an expression in English. And that is what they're trying to stop happening. They're trying to make people use what we have in Swedish. Because, of course, the more you go to another language, the more you actually lose. You probably, if you'd really worked hard enough, would find a perfectly good expression in Swedish. But it's easier to grab that handy one in English. And, of course, by that, you lose whole expressions in your own language. And they get out of usage and your language gets even poorer.
Do you do your own translations? Have you done any of your own translations
into
Swedish? No.
I had to step in and do a fairly radical rewrite on the first book that was translated into Swedish because it was a horror.
In what way? What sort of things did it have in it?
it was a bit like what you call instructions to an electrical gadget. It was an approximation of what I had written. And then it was major howlers that would have been funny if it hadn't sort of broken my heart. Like I said, young people were stepping up the housing ladder, which of course, to my mind, means that you are swapping from one, you know, you're buying a more expensive house and then sure. a more expensive house. And that was translated as all over the village, young people were clinging on to ladders outside their houses. And I also had somebody blowing a raspberry, which was translated that the old admiral spat a raspberry across the room.
So the chance that it didn't actually come to you with any queries?
No, I wish she had. She was new, and I now have a very, very fine translator, and she does a fantastic job. As much as you can when you're translating at all, and translating from a wide language to a narrower language, she's doing a fantastic job. But that first one maybe should not have been translating.
As you will know, if you've ever tried to assemble a toy or program a video recorder by following instructions written in Taipei or Canton, English in the wrong hands has a certain capacity for confusion. Here are some suitably inscrutable Oriental instructions for putting together a barbecue set. Place the handle of the blunt side of the cricket chirps and fasten the clinch and put in the complete cricket crips. Attention, please always choose a place with a coal scuttle. Also, in no case the tool should be closed and over-accommodated. Please do not pour gas or gasoline liquid. For setting fur, use setting fur material, such as setting fur paste and setting fur bolt. Well, that seems perfectly clear, doesn't it? There is no doubt that English has become the most global of languages, the lingua franca of international business, science, education, politics, and pop music. About 330 million people in the world speak English as a native language, as compared with 260 million for Spanish, 150 million for Portuguese, and a little over 100 million for French. No other language is spoken as an official tongue in more countries, 44, as against 27 for French and 20 for Spanish. And none is spoken over a wider area of the globe. Two-thirds of scientific papers, 70% of the world's mail, 90% of what is written on the Internet is in English. It is also the de facto language of international aviation.
Hello, Milano. I for you, I'm from London to Fiumicino.
Alitalia 305, buonasera, radar contact, proceed as clear.
Geneva, bonsoir, from Alitalia 305.
Geneva, Alitalia 305.
Alitalia 305, descend to flight level.
An Italian pilot flying an Italian plane into Italian airspace contacts Italian air traffic control, all speaking in English. But as I learned from retired commercial pilot John Cox, there is no guarantee that English will be the language of international air travel forever.
Well, English is the language used by most international airlines, and it is a requirement that at all international airfields, the controllers there should be able to speak not only their own local language, but also English to communicate with international aircraft. But we're not allowed to say English is the language of aviation, although in effect it really is. And because of the some other countries feel that their language should not be discredited or disregarded. And so in the official documents of the International Civil Aviation Organization, it always uses this terminology. English should be used pending the development and adoption of a more suitable form of expression for universal use. There's no sign of that coming along yet, and I doubt whether it ever will, but that satisfies the sensibilities of some people who speak other languages other than English.
And would it be right in assuming that's French? Speaking people
probably. I didn't want to say that.
But I mean, English, even for those of us who speak it as native tongues, it's a language that has a lot of scope for ambiguity. How do you get around that when you're flying airliners and communicating with...
Well, communicating with the air traffic control, we try to use standard phrases. If you want to say something out of the usual, that may be a problem, but usually most of the communications are all in standard phraseology. One particular problem we did have, I've been connected with the transport of dangerous goods on aircraft, which can be done safely if it's done properly. And in the description of dangerous goods, we have problem with this word inflammable. And even I have to think sometimes, does inflammable mean it's going to burn or it doesn't burn? And to people whose English is not their native language, it can be very confusing. And they say, well, what does it mean? Is it going to burn or not going to burn? And when you tell them that inflammable means it's going to burn, they find this sort of incredible and incomprehensible that inflammable means the same as flammable. So we have tried to standardize on the word flammable, which does away with that ambiguity.
Requiring pilots and air traffic controllers to communicate in a language other than their own would seem to be a recipe for confusion. I asked John Cox whether this was so.
Certainly has been confusion in some cases, and I don't like to talk about individual cases, but obviously there have been confusion in times of the communications between the air traffic control and the pilots, particularly where both the pilots and the air traffic controller are not native English speakers. And then you get a sort of double problem that they don't quite understand each other. We've seen some recent accidents which appear to be due to this, although the final report, for instance, of the recent crash on the approach to Delhi has not been published yet. But it would appear that there, one of the aircraft involved, one was descending, one was climbing out of Delhi, and one misunderstood which height he was cleared to. And so that's why they collided. They both ended up at the same height. And both of the pilots involved were non-native English speakers, and the controller at Delhi would be speaking with an Indian accent anyway, and so one of the pilots had misunderstood which height he'd been cleared to, and that was the reason those two aircraft collided.
So clearly English needs to be handled with care. But whatever its shortcomings and scope for misunderstandings, there's little likelihood of the world's finding, as the phrase has it, a more suitable form of expression for international use. So English is bound to remain the world's preeminent language as we move into the 21st century. The question is, what kind of language will that be? And that is our subject for next week. So far in this series, we've been looking at the growth and development of English. But it's as well to remind ourselves that English is a relative newcomer on these islands, and that there are places where other older languages are still thriving, sometimes against considerable odds. One such language is Gaelic, and one such place to hear it is here on South Uist in the Outer Hebrides. This is where our story began, with the choir of St. Peter's Church singing in the language which we might all now be speaking, had history taken any of several very slight turns. English, as we have seen, was shaped by the conquests of various peoples, Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, Vikings, directly from Scandinavia and indirectly from Ireland, and finally Norman French. And then it began a series of conquests of its own, extending outwards into the wider world and pushing native languages like Gaelic and Welsh into the furthest corners of the British Isles. Against such an onslaught, it is a small miracle that a tongue like Gaelic has survived as well as it has. Unlike Welsh, Gaelic has no official status, and its future is by no means assured. I asked Neil McMillan, a crofter on South Uist, how his native tongue is doing.
Well, fortunately, it's still holding its strength. But I can see a decline just the same. There's so much pressure from incomers who don't have the language, and they don't bother to learn the language and to be more or less integrated into the island society.
Now, just from day to day in your normal life, what proportion of the time are you using Gaelic and what proportion of the time?
Oh, we never speak a word of English among ourselves.
Really?
Never. We speak in Gaelic and we think in Gaelic and we get on with our lives.
And the same with when you meet your neighbours and so on?
Of course, yes. It's all Gaelic. We speak among ourselves. It's the Gaelic of the church. It's the Gaelic of the locality, of the Isles.
Just
Adrasta.
School teacher Mary McGuinness also lives on South Uist. Like most native islanders, Gaelic is her mother tongue. She and her husband encourage their three daughters, Jane, Jessica, and Helen, to use it also, but not always without a little gentle resistance.
Is it what you speak at home?
It is, normally, yes, all the time. Although the children want to speak a lot more English than we would like them to, and also than we do ourselves. And we have a battle getting them to speak Gaelic, although their Gaelic is reasonably good.
Why is it only reasonably good? If they've had it from birth, why?
Because they seem to have this belief that English is so much more attractive and so much more easy to speak, and the pool of television and magazines, the English world seems to be pulling them towards English, and they're not so good at hanging on to that.
But hasn't that been going on for a long time? I mean, you must have had the pull of television and radio and pop music and everything when you were...
Not to the same extent.
Right. And what sort of proportion of people in a place like South Uist do we find speak Gaelic as a native tongue?
As a native tongue, probably 90% of the people who are living there now.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Will be speaking it as a native tongue.
And what kind of health is it in overall?
Over 10 years ago, there was a program started by the local authority where the children would be taught through the medium of Gaelic, and that has made a big difference to its revival. So we're hoping that its health is going to improve from now on. So the young ones are getting taught to read, write, count, do everything through the language. That's the 5-year-olds upwards. That type of education is only 10 years old, so obviously it's going to have its own problems, but it's certainly a way of addressing the backslide that has been over the last 20 years.
And do you believe that you can save a language?
Well, I think so. We have to think, to be serious about it, and realise that it needs us for it to survive, and that every single person has their own bit to do, and if we don't do that, if one parent doesn't pass it on to their child, that's a whole line of people that are not going to have it.
And I suppose an obvious question would be, why does it matter? I mean, why does it matter to you? What is the importance of... You're going to understand each other in English anyway. English is the language of you know, Britain, certainly the modern world generally. Why is it important to you to save a little fringe language like Gaelic?
Because it's the dearest thing we have that our parents gave us, and there is no English in the world that could do for us what our Gaelic songs and our Gaelic heritage, a wealth of sayings, poems, songs, music, that could never be replaced by anything in English that I've ever heard.
Really?
Yes.
You find it much more expressive?
Oh, absolutely. It's just the language of our lives. I mean, it's so much a part of us as breathing is.
When you consider the size and strength of the language Gaelic is up against, it's hard to be too optimistic about its long-term future. Estimates of the number of people who speak English as a first language are usually placed in the range of 330 to 350 million. Not many at all compared with, say, Mandarin Chinese, which is spoken by at least double that number. However, no other language is spoken as an official language in more countries, 44, and none enjoys a wider geographical spread as a native tongue. 1.6 billion people, roughly a third of the world's population, live in countries where English has official status. And of course, it is used as a second language by more people than any other. I asked Loretta Todd of Leeds University, an expert on world Englishes, whether this was a good thing.
It's both a good and a bad thing. It's almost like everything that is good has the potential for bad as well. Now, it's good in the sense that there's communication among people where previously there was no communication. It's good in the sense that we can read in English about the cultures of other people, we can understand them better. So in that sense, the English language is, if you like, the language, the lingua franca of the world. We can all use it and talk with each other. And hopefully, if you talk, you can avoid some of the problems that previously existed. But the negative side of the English language, I sometimes think of it that English is almost like a linguistic virus, in that wonderful as it is having a very detrimental effect on local languages. I mean, as you can probably hear from my accent, I come from Ireland, and the Gaelic language that existed in Ireland has a literature that is at least as old as the literature in English. It had a grammar book in the 7th century. It has a history that one could weep over, as it were. But the English language has been so successful in Ireland that perhaps fewer than 5% of the country, of the people in the country, use Irish fully and adequately. Now, that's desperately sad. And I go to places like West Africa, and even in 10, 15 years, you can see a difference. That somebody will say, oh, my mother tongue is Lamsop, or my mother tongue is Bikom, but I don't use it anymore. And so you're finding that we're losing a lot of the linguistic wealth in the world. And I honestly think it is a little bit like the loss of the forests. We won't fully appreciate how much culture we have lost until perhaps it's too late.
Thanks in large part to its immense geographical spread, English has developed more dialects than any other language group. And particularly in its country of birth, users are passionately defensive about them, as here at the centenary gathering of the Yorkshire Dialect Society.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm getting old anyway, so dialect is not going to die in my time, but I hope it won't die next century either, because in my mind, there's no doubt at all, if you want to really stress something, it's far better dialect.
Well, you see, it saves breath as well, though, because do you know that the word something takes 1.95 seconds to say, and the word summit only takes 0.98 of a second to say? Yeah. So therefore, you see, you save your breath, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. Economical, yes. We don't waste as breath in North England, do we?
One man who knows more about dialects than almost any other is Stanley Ellis, a retired professor of linguistics at Leeds University. To help me understand just how dialects evolve, he took me to a lonely windswept ridge called Otley Shevin on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales.
Have you got your eyes closed?
Shut tight.
Right, now step forward, and you only need to do perhaps 20 or so steps at most. I'll make absolutely sure that you don't trip over any stones. And as we reach forward, say another, only another 5 or 6 yards. Are you confident?
And no, I have no confidence at all.
No confidence. There is a stone in front of you, but it won't hurt you. Now, if you just stand there quietly and open your eyes.
Wow. That's incredible, isn't it?
Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. Now, where we are, looking right down over Wharfdale, there is still on the ridge ahead of us, roughly, a boundary between what I would call the North Midland group of dialects and the Northern group of dialects. And it's tremendously important. There's a valley running up there called the Washburn Valley, which comes down into Otley, and the farmers from there would all talk North Midland. You go to the very top of the valley and you go over a few fields, and the farmers in the farms over those fields talk completely differently, because they go down to a place called Pateley Bridge, where there is their market. Market, whereas in the valley, the Washburn Valley, they come down to Otley. And north of this division, they would say Doon and Round and a boat, and there's gone in a boat there. Whereas south of it, in Otley, where we are looking, they would say Down and Round and a Bart, and I'm going down there. And the complete contrast owes its difference to a historical division that goes back to what I will call Anglo-Saxon times, but there were Anglian tribes rather than the Saxons, who were King Alfred's lot down in Wessex in the south of England. There were the Mercians, who were south of Elmet, and the Northumbrians, effectively north of the Humber, who were north of Elmet. So it's an absolutely wonderful place to stand, and you're seeing history, you're seeing language division, and you're seeing beautiful scenery as well.
It's fabulous. It is just incredibly glorious.
People get emotive about language. They think it belongs inside them. I always remember talking to people about their words, and they say, but so-and-so is real Yorkshire. And what they mean is our kind of Yorkshire, which may be East Yorkshire or North Yorkshire, which is quite different from the West Yorkshire. I had a colleague at the university who used to say, I used to travel home by bus every night up into the Heavy Woolen district, which is Dewsbury, Batley, is to the south of Leeds. And he said that he would stand in the queue for the bus and try and identify where people would get off the bus on the way home. And he said, if they got off at the wrong spot, I knew they'd flitted. He meant, I knew they'd moved house, because their speech told where they will be born in the communities on the way to his home.
But what is the future of dialects in Britain? Stanley Ellis takes a positive view.
Folks say to me now, populations are on the move, people are changing their living. You look at the ordinary people, the not very influential people, the non-Times readers, and there are mountains of folk who still live near their granny, and their mother-in-law looks after the children while they go out to work, and there's the close extended family. And these villages, and even the towns of West Yorkshire, and the Midlands, and all over the country, you've still got people who are living in tight communities, which promote, to my mind, the tight community speech. That's where your dialects come from. That there aren't a lot of outsiders forcing their way in, and people are not moving away. The only trouble is that under the pressures of modern times, which are entirely new, these dialects, I suppose, are under threat. But what I find is that they're not completely under threat for destruction in England. They're changing. Children today will talk identifiably locally, especially in pronunciation, especially in vowel and consonant sounds. But they don't talk like their grandparents. But they're still identifiably of that particular town or that part of a town. Bristol rather than Bath or whatever. And that will develop among the young.
So where now for English? We've seen in these programs how English has been mauled and molded by huge upheavals in its structure. But even now, changes are going on all the time. Changes in the way we speak and spell. 100 years ago, gold was still often pronounced gould. The first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary listed maybe as an archaic expression. 50 years ago, the Daily Mail ran an article on American expressions that it described as positively incomprehensible to the average Briton. Among the terms it listed were commuter, intern, seafood, and living room. 15 years ago, no one had heard of cyberspace or the internet or Walkmans or cafe latte or any of several thousand other terms that have poured into English and continue to pour in yet. As David Dennison of Manchester University notes, even punctuation is subject to the relentless whim of progress. The apostrophe, for example, appears to be under threat.
As knowledge of the apostrophe, its correct use in writing, disappears from Britain, I don't know if it's the same in America, people are conscious that perhaps they're doing it wrong, perhaps it might be better to use an apostrophe, and it gets thrown in, the so-called greengrocer's apostrophe, in all sorts of contexts where you don't expect it. You know, apples 50p a pound with an apostrophe before the S. Or I've even seen a respectable publisher offering their linguistics leaflet, and linguistics had apostrophe S.
Really?
Yep. And that seems to me a death row phenomenon. The apostrophe is more or less useless. It's a very recent invention anyway. It's only about a couple of hundred years old in regular use. It's clearly dying out again. It's conceivable that subtle spell checkers in modern word processors will allow it to survive rather longer than it otherwise would have. But if it weren't for that, I'd say it would probably disappear entirely in a few decades. But in those decades of its dying, it's being used where it shouldn't be, and it's not being used where it should.
John Honey, who has written extensively on the need for standards in English usage, believes the innate richness of the language is being eroded.
Militate and mitigate should be distinguished. Flaunt and flout should be distinguished. Imply and infer should be distinguished. And refute and rebut should be distinguished. Because they have importantly distinguishable meanings. Decimate has come to mean destroy. It used to mean to cull a proportion of. And I am saying that it is the function of schools, it is the function of editors to try and keep these senses apart, to discourage ignorant uses which serve to degrade the language.
But how will English sound in the future? I talked to Derek Britton of Edinburgh University.
Is it possible at all to make any kind of forecasts for where standard English is going in terms of pronunciation?
No. You cannot predict linguistic change. There are numerous possibilities, and it won't necessarily take the same route as it has before.
Now, is it possible at all to guess how long we would have to leap forward into the future before English, spoken English, would begin to sound strange to late 20th century ears?
Well, it may be if we don't, as I'm sure we won't, change our spelling system. I don't think, at my guess, you'd find it in hundreds of years possibly all that radically different. I say that because from about the sort of 18th century onwards, when writers begin to insist, well, they insisted earlier, but when it becomes to have weight, especially with the aspiring middle classes, that words are best pronounced, these are Dr. Johnson's words, Dr. Johnson, that words are best pronounced as they are spelt, then standard English spelling is actually a very formidable obstacle with that dictum then of language conforming to spelling. That's a very formidable obstacle to further change, I would have thought.
Richard Hogg of Manchester University voices a similar measure of caution in trying to predict the future of something as fickle as English.
I think overall it's probably very difficult to do so, but you can probably guess at one or two things that will happen in detail. For example, there are still a great many people who dislike the use of pronouns such as him and me being used as a subject of a sentence.
As in it's me.
As in it's me. Or John and him are going to the pictures. And what's interesting is that usage started off probably in the late 18th century and only became widespread at the beginning of the 20th century and is continuing. It seems to be on the increase all the time, so that you can see it just becoming more and more dominant. The great difficulty, however, is in looking at these kind of changes, is that we are now dealing with a population that is overwhelmingly literate and relies on written English to determine what the standard is when you're speaking, even. And that's a phenomenon that didn't exist 250 years ago. That's a new phenomenon with the rise of literacy. And what we can be fairly certain about is written language is very, very conservative compared with spoken language. And the reliance on the written language may inhibit change. So things may not move as quickly as they have done in the past.
John Honey, as we have heard, has expressed concerns about the loss of distinction in certain words. I asked him if he thought the language was in terminal decline.
One of the things that you will hear from linguists and from lay people all the time, language is in constant flux. It is stupid to try and put up barricades against particular usages which you think are to the degradation of the language. Language is in constant flux. Answer, not true. The English language is changing all the time in tiny ways. As a proportion of the total language, these small points about which the language gurus want people to be alerted and to be watchful, that the total number of those is very small as a proportion of the whole language. One of the glories of the English language is its stability over time. We can now read things that were written 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. We can attempt to read the language of Shakespeare, maybe with some help, of Jane Austen, maybe with some help, more help than is available to students studying A-level Jane Austen. But the fact is, stability is greater than flux. Stability is greater than change in the English language.
Many people in Britain and elsewhere fear that the irresistible weight of American culture will lead to what is sometimes called the coca-colonization of the world, leading, in effect, to an American takeover of English. I discussed this with David Dennison.
Should British speakers of English or speakers of non-American varieties of English be concerned about this? Should they see this as a threat?
I don't think so. I mean, power follows money. America is the powerful nation, and foreigners who want to learn English will increasingly want to follow the American pattern for learning English, and it's entirely reasonable that they should do so. I don't think it's a real danger. The contrary tendency to want to mark out your own language as individual and shared by a relatively small group is always there, it's always persistent, so there will always be differences. I don't think we're ever going to get a homogeneous dialect right across the English-speaking world. So to that extent, I'm not worried by the dominance of American language. The dominance of American culture is another thing, and we could argue about that.
Speaking personally, I would hate to see the day when all of us in the English-speaking world spoke with a uniform vocabulary and a universal accent. I asked Loretto Todd whether she thought this was remotely likely.
I don't think that's possible. I really and truly don't think that's possible. You only have to move around from one tiny little area of England to the next to realise that although we've been exposed to the same media influences, certainly as far as radio is concerned, the influence has been there for 60, 70 years. Television has been there for, 40, 50 years. And people are hearing these features, and yet local pronunciations can remain, local form, idioms and so on can remain. There may be one that would be the written standard international medium that we would all use. But I cannot see monolectal monotony, as it were. I see variation, vitality. And one of the things I also believe is that even if we became monolectal, as it were, you'd get poets and playwrights and novelists taking the language and stretching it and modifying it, and new things would come in.
This parrot is no more. It's ceased to be. It has expired.
I discovered that to most of them, Persia was little more than a vague romantic name.
Was brillig. And the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the
against the say of troubles, and by opposing...
Murder noses on red rum. Mum, it poses optimum.
Question time, these two pansies over there.
The growth of post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory and the symbiotic relation...
Can I do you now, sir?
Perhaps no other language on earth is more gloriously illogical, more dazzlingly inconsistent, more bewilderingly idiosyncratic than English. but it is also a language of great beauty and potency, a language equally at home whether dealing with the rich lyricism of a sonnet or the technological complexities of interstellar spaceflight. English will continue to evolve in ways we can't begin to guess at, and people will continue to argue over the best ways to use it. But as far as I'm concerned, until something better comes along, it'll do for me.